Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Oh, those cats were fast as lightning. What? Oh, we're live. Okay, hey. Welcome to Research on Religion. My producer caught me a bit off guard here by not telling me that we were recording. And, well, I just happened to be singing one of my favorite Carl Douglas's songs. And you know what? That's actually the only Carl Douglas song that I know. If you don't know Carl Douglas, he had the one-hit wonder Kung Fu Fighting back in 1974, topping the Billboard Hot 100 of that year. So the reason that I was singing that song was because today on the show, we are welcoming Professor Christian Novetsky to talk about martial arts and Eastern religions. And this topic came to me by request from one of our avid listeners during one of our interviews. He heard that I had practiced Taekwondo and still practice Taekwondo, and quickly pointed out that right here on the University of Washington campus, we have a professor who is teaching a class called Kung Fu Fighting and Religion. And since I like the martial arts, but know virtually nothing about Eastern religions, I figured, hey, it would be a fun topic to look into. So here we are with my guest, Christian Lee Novetsky. Christian is an associate professor in the South Asia program, the comparative religion program, and the international studies program at the University of Washington Jackson School of International Studies. As well, he serves as the graduate program chair of the South Asian program. His main area of research revolves around Marathi.
Marathi.
Marathi. Oh, okay. He's here and going to correct me on all the pronunciations today. On Marathi and Hindi materials, including textual, ethnographic, and visual/filmic sources. His recent book, Religion and Public Memory, from Columbia University Press, won the American Academy of Religions Award, the best first book in the history of religions, in 2009. Pretty spiffy. As usual, we will link to this book and to Christian's webpage on our website, so please give it a look-see. Finally, it should be noted that Christian is a longtime practitioner of the martial arts, and he has informed me that if I mispronounce any more words or if I ask any difficult questions, he's going to come over here and kick my butt, which is why I have him way on the other end of our table here in our studio. Christian, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, I should also inform our folks, and you're probably wondering, you know, why at the beginning I said my producer told me that we're live on the air when we're the only two people in here. I'm actually the producer of the show, the recorder, the sound engineer, and everything. So it's a one-bit show. Hey, before we get into talking about religion, Eastern religions, and martial arts, I want to start off with somewhat of an off-topic question here, but one that has fascinated me for a very long time, ever since I can remember, and it deals with your name. I grew up in the Midwest, and everybody there shortened their first name. Thus, Anthony became Tony, and Christian would have become Chris. However, when I entered academia, and especially when I came up here to the Pacific Northwest, I found out that very few people actually shorten their name, and that got me in a lot of trouble early on, too. So what's the deal here? Why do you go by Christian instead of Chris?
Well, I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
That's the Midwest.
That's totally the Midwest.
Yeah.
It's very hard of it. And I went by Chris all through grade school and high school. And actually, even now, if I get a call from someone and they say, "Hi, Chris," I know that it's either someone I grew up with or someone from my hometown, or someone from my family. So it's also a way to kind of, you know, filter my calls.
Uh-huh.
But I, when I went to college, I took on the name Christian, which is actually my full name,
mm-hmm.
the name my parents gave me. And that's a little ironic because my very first day heading off to college, we packed up the car and I gave my dad a hug and I looked at him and I said, I'm not a Catholic anymore.
Uh-oh.
And he got very upset.
Uh-oh.
And the first thing he said to me was, "But we named you Christian." So it's been a sore spot ever since.
You could have said back, well, you didn't name me Catholic, you know. Okay.
And in India, it often creates a kind of a funny moment because in Hindi and Marathi, the way that you say in these languages, you know, I am, my name is, I'm often saying I am Christian. And so I'll often get a kind of quizzical response from people I meet, and they'll say, well, I'm Hindu or I'm Muslim.
Yeah, so, okay.
So this is kind of a strange choice I've made.
Well, hey, I got to also ask about your middle name here. And your middle name is Lee, and I saw that on your website. And it just so happens that a famous martial artist who attended the University of Washington was also named Lee, and that was Bruce Lee. And he figures prominently on your syllabus. You actually have a picture of him right there, smack dab in the middle on top of your syllabus there. Any relation?
No, not that I know of. I mean, there could be, but I'm pretty sure that there isn't.
Okay.
Actually, my middle name comes – I had – both of my grandfathers were named Leo, and my parents decided to give me the middle name Lee. And when I asked them why, they said, well, you're named after your grandfathers. I said, well, why not Leo? They said, well, we didn't want you to think that – we didn't want one of them to think it was, you know, that one that you were named after.
Ah.
So they gave me an approximation. Okay. Kind of an odd
– Something close enough. Okay. See, I also thought that it might be a super secret ninja name, you know, and that you are related and you're like one of the dark secret ninjas here at the University of Washington. And that answer that you gave about Uncle Leo is exactly what I would expect from a super secret ninja. So I got to assume that. So that brings us to martial arts. You practice martial arts. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I started studying Shotokan karate when I was in college. And I wanted to take – it was my first year of college at McAllister, McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I wanted to take a Tai Chi course.
Mm-hmm.
And so I showed up for the Tai Chi course, but I got the times wrong. I didn't know this at the time, though. I was sitting there with a bunch of other students who were interested in this course. And this woman walked in who was extremely short. I don't know, 5 feet tall, very short, very sort of frail looking, wearing her gi and her black belt. And I suddenly sort of knew I wasn't in Tai Chi, but I felt rude about getting up and leaving. And she started talking, and I found her very compelling and interesting. And then she got up and started showing us karate. And this really small, petite body just became this whirlwind of power. And I was so amazed by her. Her name is Laura Westland. Now it's Laura Ocampo. And she still teaches and has a dojo with her husband in Minnesota, in St. Paul or St. Louis Park. Anyway, it's somewhere around there. I'm not exactly sure where. But I was so inspired by her that I started to study simply for that reason. I didn't really even have an original interest in it. It was just her. From that moment onwards, I continued my study, studying with her teacher, Sensei Fusaro, Master Fusaro, who is the chief instructor of the sort of Twin Cities Midwest area. And then I studied with someone, T.J. Stiles, who taught at Columbia University. And wherever I've gone, I've studied with people. I've studied in France and India and Ireland and England. I've studied everywhere I've gone in Texas. And right now I am learning from Sensei Chris Klein, Kathy Klein, sorry, and Chris Haight. Kathy Klein and Chris Haight are the two chief instructors of a particular branch of Shotokan karate here in Seattle.
Very cool. Very cool. And how about your religious background? You left off here talking about your dad and saying as soon as you took off for college, say, hey, I'm not Catholic anymore. You're now teaching in a religious studies department. So anything on your religious background? What drove you into the study of religion and where are you at now?
Well, that's a great question because I never really had an interest in religion, honestly.
Nor karate, apparently. I mean, you're just kind of accidentally falling through this career. It's kind of cool.
This does – you know, it's true. The things I've actually tried to do, I tried to make a living as a writer, totally failed at that. Tried to make a living as an editor, and I completely failed at that. So I think that I tend to only succeed when I'm doing something that's sort of in my periphery and it kind of moves into the center. So maybe that's the Wu Wei, the no way way, perhaps, that I'm practicing. But I was interested in India. Mm-hmm. I wanted to study India. I knew I wanted to do that through grad school. And I looked at the various disciplinary approaches to the study of India, and I found the most scope for creativity and for a kind of freedom of approach in religious studies. Because in religious studies, you have everyone. You have political scientists, you have sociologists, you have anthropologists, you have philologists, people who study literature.
Wait, what's a philologist? I'm not sure. I don't know what a philologist is.
A philologist. Philology is the foundation of all modern disciplines as far as I'm concerned. It comes out of the kind of textual, rational study of biblical exegesis and of biblical texts. But really is the foundation, to my mind, of historical evidence, of textual evidence, of figuring things out from evidence, and making proclamations about the world. So my interest in religion was really just an interest in India, and then an interest in having as much freedom as possible in studying India. So this is why I did 2 degrees in religious studies, an MA and a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But when I actually finished those degrees and I started my first job, and it was suggested to me that I teach about religion, I was dumbfounded because I didn't want to and I didn't think I knew anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, there's a stark difference between what you do as a graduate student and what you do as a professor. One key difference is you actually have to start teaching.
Yeah.
And you know, I quickly learned to teach religion, and now I really enjoy it. And just that religion as a subject itself is fascinating to me. But that came much later.
Yeah. You're right, is that when you become a professor and you have to teach the topic, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I really need to know this stuff.
Yeah.
And you learn most of your stuff through actually teaching it to others, I found. So
mm-hmm.
Very cool. All right. Let's get into today's main topic, the martial arts and how it relates to religion. Now, I mentioned in the introduction to our podcast that you are teaching a class about the martial arts here at the UW, but I somewhat misrepresented the title by saying that it was called Kung Fu and Religion, which is what my tipster, Philip Lindholm, said that the class was titled. And I said, ooh, I got to look into this. However, the official title of the class is Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting, Seminar on World Cultures Through the Asian Martial Arts. Nonetheless, a lot of the readings that you have the students do does touch upon religion. First off, though, how did you get away with teaching a class like this? I mean, this is one of those classes that when the public finds out, they shudder when they hear, whoa, this is what's going on at our public universities. It's kind of like teaching a class on the philosophical underpinnings of Jersey Shore or something. So what brought you to this class? Tell us how it came about.
Well, I first have to object to your metaphor.
Mm.
The Jersey Shore?
The Jersey Shore. Okay. All right.
I actually have had a lot of encouragement to teach this course, and I thought I would meet this kind of resistance, that people would think it was somehow not a legitimate course. And I didn't actually find that. I found quite the opposite. For one reason, the syllabus is it's a solid academic course. The students do about 40 or more pages of writing during the quarter. They have a seminar, which to my mind is a far more difficult environment for a student than a lecture, where they kind of, you know, sit sometimes semi-consciously and absorb or don't absorb. A seminar actually requires that these students, in a sense, specialize in this subject because they have to speak about it. They can't just sit there. And I feel that these components really bring together an intense academic experience, entirely aside from the martial arts aspect of it. I also think, if there are citizens of the state of Washington listening to this, that this has a direct bearing on what is very unique about this place, and I think what is in some ways some of the best that the University of Washington has to offer,
mm-hmm.
which is that Seattle is it's an international city, and it has been for a very long time, and it particularly looks towards East Asia. And the very fact that Bruce Lee is here, you know, it lies in rest here, buried here in Seattle. This inspired the course. It inspired the course not just through Bruce Lee, but through everything about his presence, the historical circumstances that would bring him here and would allow him to flourish here, that would allow him to attract people interested in his approach to martial arts, which I think is representative of the great things about this area of the country. And Bruce Lee You know, if someone hears that this is a course on martial arts, they might have in their minds, you know, a kind of kung fu movie, a couple of guys, you know, trying to beat someone up in an alley, and the guy does some whirling kicks and leaps through the air. But this approach to the martial arts that we're taking, which is emblematic of Bruce Lee's approach, is deeply invested in learning about the world that produced these arts. So while we have a practicum where we actually learn that martial art for a couple of hours, this is a way for us to figure out what it is that motivated someone with their bodies to express a kind of philosophical principle that is much larger than any martial art, and indeed is much larger than any single civilization. The influence of Buddhism or Taoism on the world is far outside of the confines of India or China or Japan or Korea. So I think this is why I didn't meet resistance, because I think people could recognize that this was not a course that someone takes because they're looking for an easy grade, or they're looking to just sort of hang out and learn some moves. This, I think, was a very demanding course, and the subject itself demands that kind of attention.
Yeah, I will vouch for that, because I did pull down the syllabus and I read through the syllabus, very extensive syllabus running 6 pages long. And, you know, and I agree with you. From people looking in at the outside, they're saying, oh, Bruce Lee and Kung Fu, what are you guys teaching? But it's oftentimes a great hook to get students interested in the class. And like you said, they said they're coming in, they're thinking, enter the dragon and I'm going to be doing some spin heel kicks around and that'll be pretty cool. But then you start realizing all the discipline and other things that go into this, as well as the religious influences, the environmental influences from around the different cultures. And yeah, it's a great hook. I do that as well. I teach with the Simpsons and a bunch of other stuff in my classes. So and which is, by the way, why I never have my classes recorded, because people, if they only get a snippet from the outside, they go, what are you doing? I'm doing some good stuff. And I should tell you too that when I read through your syllabus, although the class doesn't say religion explicitly in the title, you do have a lot of books that deal explicitly with the martial arts and religion, including Zen in the Martial Arts by Joe Hymans, Tao of the Jeet Kune Do by Bruce Lee himself, Zen Flesh and Zen Bones, sounds like a cool one, is a book compiled by Paul Reps, and interestingly enough, Yoga, Discipline of Freedom by L. John Wertheim. And
actually, the Yoga, Discipline of Freedom is Barbara Stoller Miller.
Oh, okay.
Wertheim wrote a really interesting book called Blood in the Cage, mm-hmm. which is a book about Pat Miletich and mixed martial arts.
Which is very similar to yoga, I find. Maybe
do
not.
You?
No, I don't. I don't.
They are very similar.
Well, we're going to have to talk about that. So let's go ahead and do that. I mean, one of the first things that you start off with, and I just want to basically walk through your syllabus here in our interview today so that our listeners can get a flavor for what your 10-week course is. And for those of you who are not familiar with the University of Washington system, we do operate on a 10-week quarter system. So if you're thinking, wait a minute, my semesters are 15, you're getting away with not 5 or 5 weeks throwing them out. No. 10 weeks is a full week course here. You start off early in the course with yoga. Help me out here. First of all, I never thought of yoga as a martial art. In part, I have been practicing some yoga now since I've had a shoulder injury, and I go into that classroom and it's nothing like my taekwondo. You know, we're going to do self-defense. You're going to come away with some bruises here. Second of all, I never thought of yoga as a religion, but rather more as a, I guess, stretching class for either high-strung suburbanites or hipster urban yuppies. So what gives here? How is yoga a martial art?
Well, that's a great question. And the reason why I put this in here is exactly to ask this question. And I think that there are a couple of ways to answer it. One way is to say that from my point of view, I've never viewed martial arts as self-defense. I think of martial arts something more like self-actualization that deals with one of the essential features of human life, and that's conflict. And so there's a way in which yoga is directly related to this. Yoga is a practice of self-actualization. In its oldest form, it's not the positions that we think of now. Actually, the only position that is enumerated in that very first text that we have, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, is just to sit quietly. That's the only thing he tells you to do. It doesn't tell you you have to put one leg behind your head or anything like that. You just need to sit quietly, control your breathing, and to allow the outside world's influences to fade away.
So it has a meditative quality to it.
It has a meditative quality, but then it has a transcendent one. And what you transcend is the human, the limitations of your body. Yoga, the philosophy of yoga is based on the idea that we're entrapped, we're encased in a body that has certain distractions that lead us away from a kind of ultimate reality that we can perceive if we can limit that distraction. And the body then becomes, instead of a liability, it becomes a great tool to use to focus the mind. So if in everyday life people wander around with their bodies distracting them, yoga uses that same power of distraction to turn it into an instrument of enlightenment, an instrument of realization. And I think that that idea is the first idea that distinguishes a martial art from any kind of pugilistic enterprise. Just sort of, you know, how best to punch someone in the face. I think the distinction with a martial art comes out of this idea of transcending the self, of overcoming the self, both the physical limitations of the self and those mental or spiritual limitations that we bring very often into conflict. Aggression, fear, anxiety, anger. And, you know, there really are no martial arts that call themselves martial arts that don't at some fundamental level deal with that problem, the problem of the self.
Mm-hmm. Let me stop you there. And you used a term, and I kind of get an idea of what it's about, but I want you to define it better, and that is self-actualization. What's that?
Well, what is self-actualization? Well, it's a psychological term that comes from this fellow, I'm forgetting his name, Maslow. Mm-hmm. You know, he has this pyramid of sort of self-actualization and the satisfaction of certain basic requirements so that you can liberate the self. What I mean by that is something like the yogic notion that there's a fundamental self to all of us that is covered over by our daily and regular lives that create another kind of self, the kind of the cloak of the self, our professorships and our sense of sort of who we are in the world. But there's a kind of unifying human self at the core of every individual. And to actualize that is to make that a reality in your life, something that you can think about, something that you contend with. Now, we think of that very often in self-help context, mm-hmm. right? So there certainly is one way towards that kind of self-actualization. In the martial arts, my theory is that it emerges from yoga. And the reason why I have this theory is that in the legacy of the origin of martial arts, in China, for example, it's commonly understood that these techniques of using the body in a skillful way, in a way that transcended its limitations, came along with Buddhism. So it came along with a kind of religious emigration throughout Asia many centuries before the Common Period and continuing after the Common Era. And what these Buddhist monks were practicing, in part, was yoga. That is meditation. Mm-hmm. That is this is, of course, what the Buddha does. The Buddha tries all these different techniques to reach enlightenment. He essentially gets fed up and says, I'm just going to sit under this tree. I'm just going to stop thinking. I'm just going to sit here, and I'm going to wait for it to come to me. This is the essence of yoga. And I think that these monks and others who are carrying this idea translate this into a kind of effective means in action. And certainly this comes at some point to be an issue of self-defense. But it never loses its mooring in what I'm calling self-actualization. It never loses that connection to the kind of fundamental energy that a person has that they can unleash. And you really see this so commonly. We just had a Brazilian jiu-jitsu class. And Brazilian jiu-jitsu is a fascinating martial art because it essentially begins by placing you in what is arguably your most vulnerable position, on your back with a larger opponent on top of you. And it suggests that without Brazilian jiu-jitsu, that is a very vulnerable position. Without a practice of skillful means that allows you to transcend your limitation, that you're smaller than your opponent and you're in a bad position vis-a-vis your opponent. If you can't transcend that, then you're sort of lost. But Brazilian jiu-jitsu teaches you a way to transcend that. That is the martial aspect. Now, the art of it is that Brazilian jiu-jitsu has no attack. I mean, you know, we once talks about attacking from your back, attacking an arm, attacking a leg. But the Brazilian jiu-jitsu starts with two people facing each other, and the Brazilian jiu-jitsu person is awaiting an attack. No offense to my Brazilian jiu-jitsu colleagues out there, but if you've seen a Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner punch, there's not a lot going on, or kicks. It's to distract their opponent so they can get in. And even if they get them on the ground, they usually don't want to punch and hurt their opponent. They want to get their opponent in a position where their opponent has the freedom to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is a nice example of how the martial and the art combine, because it begins with this idea that you transcend yourself. You transcend your desire to express your anger by attacking an opponent. Instead, you absorb the anger of your opponent and you figure out a way to help them realize they should give up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it comes from yoga.
I see this now. And, you know, as I went through the martial arts, my son was the first one to get into this, and he brought me into the practice of it. He thought it was all going to be whirling dervish punching and kicking, but a lot of the stuff that he learned was self-control and the mastery, as you say, the mastery of your body. And then there's this other aspect to it, the transcendent part, where, you know, during our black belt testing, we did have to take a very long period where you just had to, you know, sit. And, you know, go somewhere else. And that becomes the very transcendent aspect of this. Now, it was somewhat interesting because I trained with a guy who is a strong Christian, and we trained at a barn just offside of an evangelical church. And that brings up this other issue about yoga that I have to talk about, because, again, I never thought about it as a religion. I see it in the gym. It seems to be a stretching class. Oh, they chant at the end. You mentioned this transcendent stuff, and I'm not sure if that's necessarily connected with a deity or not, but it could be just finding a way to metaphysically leave your body for a while and become a better master of your body. But in recent years, and maybe this has been going on for a long time, some evangelicals have become very critical of yoga. And I'm thinking recently here in the Seattle area, Mark Driscoll, who we've had a podcast with in the past, has called yoga the work of the devil. Explain that to me. How do you view that as somebody who understands yoga as something transcendent?
Well, I think this is all a matter of definition. And I think I agree with Mark Driscoll.
Mm.
Because he's setting the terms of the debate.
Mm-hmm.
That it's if you have a practice that mentions any other kind of understanding of spirituality other than his definition of Christianity, then it is demonic. It's worshiping another god, and through that sort of drawing you away from truth. Then yes, I suppose it is demonic for some people. So that's just a matter of terms that one uses. And I don't think that he's wrong. And I think he understands that, Hindu yoga, which is generally the kind of yoga that is taught. With exceptions, of course, but, you know, especially in Seattle, there are a lot of yoga institutes that are very explicitly Hindu. They use Hindu terms and they use Hindu texts. But the history of yoga is a history of a technique. Simply a technique, which is yoga. It's actually what the word means, a technique or a discipline, to accomplish some trimming of the layers of reality so that a deeper understanding of the world is possible. And this is a practice undertaken by Buddhists and Hindus, as well as by Muslims, particularly through Sufism, by Christians, really by anybody of any religious persuasion. And if you accept my argument, by Taoists, by Confucianists, by Buddhists, all throughout the Buddhist world. So there's no religious content in that sense. It would be like, you know, if you can just imagine technique, a prayer as a technique, contemplation as a technique. This is a form of that. But he is right to say the dominant form of that, that maybe many of the people who come to his church would have encountered, may have been explicitly Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're talking about the history of yoga, then he's not right if he believes that yoga has always been invested with the requirement that one worship a Hindu deity. Actually, in the history of yoga, you have a philosophy that undergirds it that is what I would describe as non-theistic. It does not require a god. Yoga itself, though, is theistic. And the Yoga Sutras begin by naming that god, Ishvara.
Okay.
Now, that's just the word for Lord, but it generally means Shiva. But, so the debate is really a debate that that has a lot more to do with, has to do with an idiosyncratic theology, I would say, than it has to do with anything that helps us understand yoga, for example.
Now, you mentioned something really important here that has always confused me about Eastern religions, and that you said that yoga historically has not necessarily been a theistic religion. In its Hindu practice, it has been. But as I understand it, many of the Eastern religions, such as Buddhism or Taoism, don't necessarily have a deity or a theism like the Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, where God is a creator or interactor with the world. Set me straight on this. What is the theistic nature of some of these religions, Buddhism, Taoism, yoga?
That's an enormously difficult question to answer.
Well, that's what I do on this show.
So there are certainly many Hindus who will tell you that they are monotheistic, that they worship one god. They'll tell you who that god is, and they will tell you that god is not just their god, that god is God. That is, in the Judeo-Christian Islamic world, monotheism doesn't mean that's the god that they worship. It means that is everyone's god, whether you worship that god or not. That's the sort of notion of monotheism. And you would certainly find some Hindus who would have that perspective. You may also find Buddhists who worship Buddha. You will also find many, many Hindus who find that that God has many representations. Or maybe those representations are absolutely distinct and there are actually many gods. There's no way to answer that for Hinduism alone, because I think that you can't really consider Hinduism a unified religion. It's got no central text, central dogma, central figure, central leadership. There's nothing like that to organize it. Buddhism is somewhat different because Buddhism emerges from a historical figure, which is unlike Hinduism, which has no historical founder or no historical founding text, but has this sort of plethora of texts and people and ideas throughout time. So Buddhism, this tends to become more of a debate, particularly in practices of Buddhism that take the Buddha as a deity. But even in these contexts, yoga is very common. And I think yoga is common because the foundation of Buddhism is a recognition of the way that desire leads to suffering. And one of the chief ways to control desire is to control the self, to follow the Eightfold Path and to understand how to behave in the world. So there, I think that we have, again, what I would describe as a non-theistic approach, which is to say theism can or cannot be a part of it, but it doesn't need to be a part of it in order for the whole to kind of make sense.
And that, for me, it's very interesting, again, when you consider Driscoll's characterization of yoga and or the way he sets the debate and how he conceives of things. Because, again, if you're coming at yoga from a more self-actualization without deism, there might not be a problem with the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not take, the other gods before me. And so that, I guess it depends upon how one views this stuff.
Yeah, I think that Mark, I don't know if I can call him Mark. I'll just call him Mark.
Pastor Driscoll.
Mark, you can call me.
Okay. You can call
Christian if you want. Or Chris. I think that he's a very provocative and interesting thinker. I don't know if you know that he's also said a few things about MMA, about mixed martial arts, that I find very interesting.
Oh, what? Tell me about that, because we're going to finish up with mixed martial arts, because that's the for me the interesting fun part, fist to flying kind of thing. And there's some few surprises on this. But what has Pastor Driscoll said about MMA, mixed martial arts?
Well, it's been a while since I've read his posting. I think he did it maybe it was October. But what I recall he wrote is he sort of addressed a question, which is it a Christian thing to practice mixed martial arts? And I believe, of course, anyone listening to this will have to read what he's written, because I'm just going from memory. But that he more or less approves of it, and even thinks that there's a certain positive lesson in it for Christians. And I wouldn't, I really don't know, you know, what that lesson is, though I think there are many positive lessons and I can imagine what they might be. My one interest that I have in MMA that I think dovetails with his interest is in how many devout Christians practice it at the very highest levels. If you look at one organization, the UFC, and you look at the champions, about half of them are devout Christians who, as soon as they get that microphone after a victory, they praise Jesus.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that they do. Many of them have tattoos that that reference biblical passages. And what they see is what they see themselves doing in that cage fighting another person, they do not see an opposition. They actually see quite hand in hand with their faith. And I think that Mark is bringing out a fascinating relationship emerging there. As we're discussing Eastern religions and martial arts, I think you have an emerging relationship between Christianity, Western Christianity, and mixed martial arts that very few people have discussed, and I really would hand it to him for bringing that up.
Yeah, since we're here, I was saving that till the end, but we're here and talking about it. And one of the fascinating things that you pointed out to me in our email conversations and setting up this interview was the number of hardcore Christians there are in the mixed martial arts. And this brought up a story, or I recalled a story when I was traveling to Salt Lake City, about a decade ago, on an airplane, sitting next to some guy, very short guy, and we start chatting, and he says, "Oh, yeah, I'm a Mormon." And I said, "Oh, yeah, what do you do for a living?" He says, "I'm a cage fighter." Okay, that one doesn't fit. You know,
be on that poster. I'm a Mormon.
I'm a Mormon, yes. And a cage fighter. Yeah. And so that was one of these things that was rather difficult for me to square. And, you know, he's also a father of four. And I, you know, again, throughout the rest of the flight, it was a fairly short flight, just trying to put all that stuff together. But I don't know. What do you make of the relationship between Christianity or any kind of spiritual faith and, you know, something as brutal as mixed martial arts? Now, we were just talking about yoga, and that's very peaceful, but, you know, you turn on pay-per-view television to watch the, you know, latest MMA championship round, and, you know, that's not yoga. That's not all that peaceful, and I guess I don't see the self-actualization occurring there. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I am not a practitioner of MMA, so I don't know that world well. I know that world as a curious observer, but I don't know it as someone on the inside of it. So that's a difficult question to answer. But there is a way to approach a kind of general answer, which is that whenever we see these physical practices emerge, we, for whatever reason, see a religion attach itself to them, or this physical practice attach itself to a religion. So we have every reason to believe that yoga emerges independently of any religious proclivity. Let's say around the time of Buddhism, which is also the time of the Upanishads and of sort of early thinking that's speculative in South Asia.
How long ago was that? Give us a rough time.
Let's say 6th century BC, okay. Around that time. 7th century BC, 6th century BCE. When we have this kind of thinking, that is about a kind of transcendence, which is a transcendence really of physical limitation. And if after that transcendence one encounters nirvana, total extinguishment, or whether one encounters moksha, the Hindu idea of total connection and oneness in some senses with ultimate reality in Hinduism, whatever that is, we have the discipline first that then becomes attached to these religious principles. So if we see this happen, if we imagine that, let's say, Korean martial arts or Japanese martial arts emerge out of a practical environment where, for example, the samurai needed to know what to do if he dropped his sword, so they developed something like jiu-jitsu, that at some point Zen comes to explain in some way that art. If this happens with Kung Fu and Taoism comes to explain somehow that art, then we can see this pattern of an art, some sort of physical martial practice becoming absorbed or absorbing a religious explanation or a religious affiliation. And that's why I don't really see it as surprising that people who excel at the martial arts, but really at anything, don't at some point recognize some divine or supernatural inspiration for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see that a lot in other professional sports. Tim Tebow and, you know, Jeremy Lin and are big in the news nowadays. But yeah, you do, or even musical performances, artistic, other forms of arts that are not necessarily all that physical do have that spiritual transcendent dimension. And that's a very interesting point that you make, that it somehow explains things that are happening within that realm.
Well, I think the Jesuits do this.
How so?
Well, the Jesuit, what are the Jesuits first? This is an order that is created for the safeguarding of the Catholic, let's use that term, church. But their martial training precedes that mandate in the sense that there was already a sort of a martial tradition of knighthood that then comes under this banner of the defense of the church, and God is on the side of the Jesuit. The Jesuit is a warrior for God, whether that war is taken in, you know, by the pen or by the sword. So something similar happens in that context.
That's very interesting. I would have never at the beginning of this interview thought that I would now use the word Jesuits as a tag word on my website when we're dealing with martial arts and Eastern religions. But here it is. It connects all well together.
Well, that's what they are. They're martial artists. They were.
Yeah.
In some sense, martial artists. They're not. I don't think they are anymore. I have some friends who are Jesuits. I don't think that they're martial artists. But it has that sense that it's not just they're not just swinging their swords. There is a divine power. Or supernatural, whatever term you want to use. In martial arts, the term is chi or ki very often, which is a power that you generate, which is not, it's not supernatural, but you're not going to get it if you're just sitting around watching TV all the time. Mm-hmm. You have to cultivate it.
I don't know. I've seen some pretty good television shows lately.
Well, I do think that that there's a trend there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have any scientific evidence for it. But then I'm a humanist, so I don't have any scientific evidence for anything.
Yeah, well, that's okay. We'll forgive you. You can turn it over to the social scientist, and we'll take it from there. But actually, fascinating observation. I would have never made these connections or think about it. But as you say, yeah, this really does make a lot of sense. I want to return back to your syllabus and walk through this a little bit, because we have taken a very interesting tangential path through a number of different topics here. Yeah, but I want to bring it back to Eastern religions. And one of the other things that you address on your syllabus is Kung Fu, Confucianism, and Taoism. So you have about 2 or 3 weeks, I think, devoted in your class to that topic. What are the students learning out of there? Tell us the lessons.
One thing that they're learning is they're reading these texts. So one major goal I have for this course is to get students into a class they would not normally take, to read texts they wouldn't normally read, but texts that I think can expand their view of the world and possibly their view of themselves. So I consider Confucianism and Taoism to be in that category of, you know, the kind of thing that you should read when you're in college. I think that college... it has to be practical. It obviously has to be practical. But we tend to confuse what is practical with what is often called theoretical. We tend to separate them. But I think that one approach to skillful means, let's call that practical, being practical, knowing a practical way to address a problem, is to understand the multiple ways that people imagine themselves in this world, that they imagine their plight in this world. I mean, we're all condemned to die, for example, mm-hmm. and this is a major theme of most world religions, many world philosophies, that what does this shared suffering mean? No one can escape it. And I think that that for students who go on to anything in their lives, to have this kind of openness and knowledge about the way the world has approached problems of suffering and conflict are vital. So we read Taoism, for example. Taoism, we read Chuang Tzu, and we also read the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu.
Now, what is Taoism? I'm familiar with it, but clue me in a little bit more.
Well, to answer that question, you've got to kind of delve into Chinese history, and you need to also enter into debates about what is defined by this. In general, it is a philosophy that seemed to offer an alternative, which is sometimes critical of Confucianism, and an alternative that's sometimes in line with Confucianism, but a kind of a philosophy of being that emphasized a middle path, a way to avoid extremes. So often the term harmony is used when discussing Taoism, a way to kind of be at peace with things around you. Now, when I read Lao Tzu, what I read when I read Lao Tzu is a kind of disaffected bureaucrat who basically got really upset with his job and decided to wander off and was quite bitter. And he actually seems to pose a challenge. So when you read this, when you read Taoism, you're reading a text that is addressed, I think, to leaders, to sort of middle management and CEOs, saying, you know, the way I was treated isn't the way you should treat people, and this is the way you should treat people. When you read Chuang Tzu, you read a much different text that is interested in absurdity and play and humor, and is really, to my mind, the precursor of what will later become the Zen koan in Japan, for example, or a similar genre in Korean Buddhism, which is the statement that on the face of it seems somewhat absurd. The sound of one hand clapping is the most famous mm-hmm. one. But that absurdity and that play and that what it sparks in your brain when you hear it and you think about it and you think, oh, that's really ridiculous. What could they possibly mean? Is exactly the effect that it's meant to have. So it's, again, a text that tries to divert you from the way things are done regularly, which is not a good way to do things, and have you think in a new way, in a novel way. So Taoism is something in that order, right? So you have I've named two texts. The texts, I think, are very different, but they both share this desire to change perspective and to create a relationship between the individual and society in particular that is more fluid and forgiving of difference.
Okay. And how does this relate to Confucianism? What is Confucianism? That becomes the philosophy of the imperial court of many Chinese dynasties. And so I have often thought of that not so much as a religion, more as a secular philosophy. So how does this fit into the scheme of things?
Well, I also don't really think of it as religion. I don't think of Taoism as religion either. So as you pointed out, the course isn't about religion, but religion gets in there.
And, yes, yes.
And Taoism, if you want to study Taoism anywhere in the country in higher education, you're going to probably walk into a religious studies class, or you're going to walk into a sort of Chinese literature class, right? But you're not going to. It's not going to be taught in poli-sci probably, or in philosophy. Even though I think it's a philosophy, and I think it's about politics. How these become classified as religion has maybe a lot to do with Orientalism and all that kind of thing, which, you know, everybody kind of knows about, right? But Confucianism is a very particular and interesting puzzle. It's interesting historically because it, in the name of Confucius, there comes to be this kind of world order, right? This the Confucianism is basically about relationships between people. That you owe an obligation to your mother, to your father, your children owe an obligation to you, your king owes an obligation to you, you owe an obligation to the king owes an obligation to what generally we'll just call heaven, but sort of, you know, the cosmos controlling things, and he can lose that connection and so on. So it's about proper relationships and things moving properly among those groups. And so it is kind of definitionally about a kind of cosmic bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. It has that metaphysical aspect to it.
Well, it does. I think it does have a metaphysical aspect to it, and that is an interesting part of it. And I don't know if you remember this. I remember this, that there used to be these sort of Confucius says things that would be in the paper.
Yeah.
Do you remember
that? Oh, yeah.
And the implication is that these are pearls of wisdom, of sort of religious and metaphysical wisdom. And Confucius is obviously well known for having delivered some bon mots from time to time,
mm-hmm.
right? But that became part of that kind of Orientalizing is a kind of a dirty word, but that became part of the world of the entry of Chinese culture into Western culture. Mm. Confucius says was one of those things.
Yeah, yeah. And for our listeners, you mentioned Orientalism, and that's generally thought of here in academia as the process of imposing Western cultural views upon another culture and reinterpreting it through that lens.
Or figuring out a way to devalue a culture that is in that you wish to have in a political subordinate position to you.
Got it. Yes. Okay.
So if we orientalize a group of people that we seek to colonize in some way, then that makes it easier. But what I wanted to add was we find now that Confucianism suffered a kind of a withdrawal from public culture in China after the revolution, but has now seemed to return in the form of these Confucian institutes, and the University of Washington will host one. And I find this really fascinating, that China's sort of soft power political effort to sort of place these institutes around the country, that this is done in the name of Confucius. I think it's very savvy. But it also, I wonder if it will feed back upon Chinese culture in some way and reify yet another kind of Confucianism for us. We have so many stages of it. Sort of the original, the Neo-Confucian, and so on. Confucianism as it travels to Japan and Korea. Maybe yet we have another for the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, we're talking a lot about interpretations of Buddhism and of Taoism and of Confucianism as very high academic level. But, you know, I've also seen it discussed, and you can correct me on this, is that at the level of the common folk, the folks who are not the high academics sitting around thinking about this stuff all the time, that Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism often does take on a much more religious sense than what it maybe originally was intended to be. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think that is the, you know, we have this difficulty with saying what is religion. You
yeah.
know, and that's
yeah.
always this struggle. And my own theory about this is it's entirely made up by modernity so that we can have a particular kind of grab bag of things that need to be more or less separated from the functions of the modern world, science, a secular state, these kinds of things, right? I mean, because what's a greater challenge to the state than religious institutions? They're the only ones that have that kind of level of organizational power that the state does.
Mm-hmm.
And also the power to discipline, the power to...
Yeah, an appeal to authority other than the state. There's something above and beyond mm-hmm. the state, right? The metaphysical entity, deity, what have you.
Mm-hmm. So I think that we run into this problem of what is religion when we say, is Taoism religious? Is Confucianism religious? And that is where I would position that. I would say, so in other words, I would say it's religious simply because you've already defined religion as something that must absorb this practice, which is a lot like Mark Driscoll's comment about yoga. It's demonic as long as you maintain a certain agreement on what demonic means and what qualifies. If you change that at all, then, I mean, there's no demon in yoga, obviously. There's no notion of a devil tempting anyone or anything like that. But, you know, if you define it in a certain way, you can certainly call that demonic. There are plenty of people who I think that the secular Western Academy is demonic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, demonic is a term that can mean everything or nothing. Same thing with religion. It can mean an awful lot, but when you kind of break it down, does it really tell you anything at all except about the point of view of the person who's just uttered the word? But I take advantage of that, actually. I take advantage of that as an opportunity to teach. Because I think the best place to start teaching is through stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Explain that. Tell me how.
Well, it's the thing people are already equipped to talk about. So if we want to teach a course about, if you want to teach a course, I'm about any side. Which could we choose? Marxism. If you want to teach a course about Marxism, you start with stereotypes. Marx thinks that all religion is the opiate of the masses that suppresses their sense of freedom, keeps them, you know, toiling laborers. If you start there, then you automatically have people who have heard that somewhere, and they can start discussing that with you. And this is why I begin this class with that song. So mm-hmm. I begin with that song, and I begin with something that's a little sort of...
That song mean the Carl Douglas song?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, good. You got that too. There's two people in Seattle that own that song then.
And that, you know, and I do that because I sort of welcome the stereotype
yeah.
that comes in of the Chinese Kung Fu master.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a place for – so one of the assignments I give my students is I have them go in and interview accomplished martial artists. And they find people from all walks of life. And they find people from all sorts of different approaches. And they find that the stereotypes they had about the karate master who's a pugilist or the Tai Chi master who's a sort of – you know, a wilting flower.
Yeah, when flighty, the person, new age. Yeah,
when
yeah.
the person is actually, you know, very grounded and knows how to use Tai Chi to defend herself or himself. You know, I play with those stereotypes. I'm sure you do too. You start with The Simpsons, and The Simpsons is just a collection of stereotypes.
Yep, that would examines them further and deeper in many respects. And you know, as you mentioned earlier on in your first encounter with this, when you thought you were taking a Tai Chi class, and in walks this 5 foot, 100-pound gal who all of a sudden is a whirling dervish of power and energy, and that probably impacted you a great deal on how you look at this kind of stuff, I would imagine. Yeah. So let's talk about just a little bit of this and just give a little bit more flavor in the time that we have remaining here. One of the things that I was interested in, you have a section on Zen and the martial arts. Now, Zen is talked a lot about here. It usually comes up in the sporting world with what's the guy's name? They used to coach the Lakers and the Bulls.
Oh, yeah. What is his name? I know who you're talking about.
Yes, but he's a Zen master, and he just sits silently while his mega million-dollar superstars are out there squabbling on the court. What is Zen, and how does it relate to the martial arts?
Well, I chose a text called Zen in the Martial Arts by Joe Hyams, who was actually a reporter in L.A., but just spent a lot of his time learning martial arts from various martial arts masters of a particular period, the kind of efflorescence of Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris and other, you know, famous martial artists at this particular time and in this place around, you know, Hollywood. So he's interesting for that reason, and he writes a book where he uses Zen kind of like Zen is used in that book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So here it seems to be an opportunity to collect together anecdotes, stories that express something, again, about the control of the self, about one's expectations, how your stereotypes will fail you in the real world where things are much more complex. He tells a lot of stories of conflict with himself and with others and how he resolved them rather than turn to any kind of violence or any kind of violence of the self, you know, being self-defeating behaviors. So that's the Zen part. That particular text is not really about Zen as it emerges as a specific kind of Buddhism in Japan, related to Chuan in China and Korean Zen Buddhism. Now, in those contexts, Zen is a kind of Buddhism that emphasizes, how do I say it? So in a lot of religions, you have this conflict between a kind of textual, philosophical wisdom approach, and you have an approach that's immediate, experiential, and available really to anyone. And Zen is that latter. Zen is the approach to Buddhism that says that you can study Buddhism your entire life and read every single sutra you can get your hands on. But it's when you meet that master who smacks you on the head with his bamboo stick, and suddenly you're enlightened. Zen seems to suggest to me that it's about fracturing the complacent reality that you live in. When that fracture occurs, you have that point of light that shows you reality. And Zen stories, one of the texts you mentioned is Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, a collection of stories from a really broad time period, many contemporary stories, some really old stories. But they all kind of share this quality of that moment of enlightenment when something just comes to you. You see a fish leap out of the water, and then suddenly you get it. I'm life after life. I'm like that fish, leaping and leaping, and now I'm enlightened. Though fascinating thing, that's Zen in general. One fascinating thing is that Zen, maybe for this reason, becomes deeply imbricated in the martial arts, especially through samurai, and then later through Japanese martial arts of different kinds, karate and aikido. And there it becomes, this is talked about in a book on my syllabus, The Book of Five Swords, which is written by a famous 17th century samurai who had 26 duels, and a duel for a samurai in the 17th century is I cut your head off or you cut my head off. So, you know, it's not like a mixed martial arts bout where both parties get back up and go out for a beer afterwards. This is somebody dies. And he survived them all, obviously, and at the end of his life reflected on the fact that if you do something so well that you don't think about it, that this for him was Zen. If you are so good at striking down your opponent that you've thought about it and thought about it so much that you know exactly what to do, you've transcended somehow all of those little steps you take for an action, and you do it with a kind of deep spiritual connection to the goal of the object. And the thing about him is that he says, he doesn't say this explicitly, but when you read his text, the reason why his text is so popular is it's translatable to anything from his point of view. If he's great at chopping someone's head off. If he tells you sort of how to reach that point, then you'll be great at negotiating your business deal or at teaching your class or at getting your children potty trained or whatever it is that you do. So there's another insight to Zen, which is, again, that skillful means insight, that insight that suggests that we think too much about what we do and that the real master is someone who may have put a lot of thought into it, but they've reached a point beyond that.
Yeah. And I can definitely see how that resonates with the martial arts is, you know, when you start doing this, I did Taekwondo, and you start learning the different process of it, and you're very clumsy at doing it. But there is a moment that all of a sudden it clicks. And the other way I've experienced this was with language training, right? You memorize all the verbs and the conjugation and all that kind of stuff. But then all of a sudden, just one day you wake up and you got it and you don't think about it. And whereas in previously you're thinking, okay, I need to speak to this person. I need to conjugate this verb in the past tense and use this gerund. But then all of a sudden it just happens. In many ways, how language just occurs to us naturally, we use it without thinking about it.
That is a great point. And I think that has something to do with the Zen literary tradition of the koan. So the koan assumes that you don't need to get out a dictionary to understand what has just been said.
Yeah.
What is the sound of one hand clapping? That's only going to make sense if you have the linguistic ability to immediately visualize the verbal formula that's come to you.
Yeah.
And I think that you have a really good, you know, metaphor there. Actually, when I teach Hinduism, I tell my students, I'm not teaching you about a religion. I don't want you to even think of Hinduism as a religion. It's an entirely different debate. I teach it to them as a language. And I try to teach them the parts of the language and tell them that people are creative with it. They rearrange its pieces to come up with their own sentences, their own meaning. There are certain rules, but beyond those rules, there's a tremendous flexibility. And once you know the rules, you can actually break them too. So I like to think of the religious manifestations of Hinduism as something like poetry, a master of the language who has figured out how to impart meaning through what they do. And I think this could be applied to Zen, to maybe other things as well.
A lot of other things, yeah. Okay, we're kind of near at the end of our podcast here, and there might be some folks who are here in the Seattle area that, you know, maybe want to, you know, take this course and stuff. So you need to enroll in the University of Washington, but I'm sure you'll be teaching this course again in the future. Give us a recap. We had just finished our winter term here. We are actually recording this March 12th, and that's the beginning of our finals week. How did the students react to this? Over the 10-week period, did you see any changes that the students went through? Were there any big surprises? And did you yourself learn anything through teaching this course?
Well, let me start with your last question. I learned that so I put this course together because I wanted to teach a course that I wanted to take. I wanted to put together a course that I wish someone had put together for me to take when I was in college. And at first I felt rather selfish about that. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized this is actually good pedagogy. That I think that if I put myself in the position of my students, I remember what that was like, and I think of a course that I wish I could have taken at that point in time, then I'm actually doing a great service to them. Rather than not thinking of them at all, I'm actually designing it with just them in mind. And so I realized, one thing I realized is that is the way that I should teach, and, you know, far be it for me to tell other people how they should teach, but I think that it's one way to evaluate one's own courses, because so often we teach courses that we wouldn't like to sit through our own lectures.
Or they've been handed down to us.
Right. And so I had an opportunity because of the University of Washington is such an amazing place, and because the Jackson School in particular is fantastic. And I got such tremendous support from International Studies, the Center for Global Studies, which is run by Sarah Curran, and Tamara Leonard, and from Jim Wellman, who I know was interviewed here, and Comparative Religion, and my colleagues in South Asia Studies, and just sort of across the board, I had tremendous support from the dean's office and from the IMA, which, you know, the IMA is our gym, and they really went out on a limb doing this.
As you mentioned at the beginning of the course or the interview here, you know, there's a two and a half hour session each week where mm-hmm. you go into one of the rooms there, has a bunch of mats, and you do the martial arts.
Yeah, we bring in a guest instructor and we do the martial arts. The IMA was extremely accommodating and they were wonderful. So as I said, you know, at the beginning, I had actually not resistance, but I had great support. I mean, it took a while to sort of explain it, but once I explained it, great support, which is just another great thing about this university. But so I learned that, you know, that in an environment that actually privileges teaching, like the University of Washington, that this is an approach to take that's very fruitful. Now, my students, we're discussing the whole time, and they're writing the whole time, so I get a sense. But of course, they may in part just want to please me.
Yeah. But you never know what students are thinking. You look on those heads; they're either, you know, the students who are sleeping actually might really be getting it, and students who are nodding happily are probably thinking of ways to dock you on your evaluations or something. Yeah.
But you know, I had students. All of my students were IS students or CHID students.
Would you explain what those are for our listeners?
Well, IS is International Studies, okay. And that's in the Jackson School, and CHID is this stunning program here at the University of Washington called the Comparative History of Ideas. And they were extremely supportive, and they co-sponsored this course as well. And this is an ideal course for them, is that they really do have some very interesting experiential learning opportunities for students. But I mention that because the students that come out of CHID and International Studies are exceptional. They're exceptional because they learn critical thinking skills and they learn writing. And for that reason, I think I had an ideal kind of pool of students. I had one or two students from other disciplines. I had a great student in biology who was very worried because he said, I'm a biologist, I don't write anything. But he wrote a really great paper. And yeah, I had great students. But a couple of things I noticed. I had almost 100% attendance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never experienced that before.
How big was the class?
It was 21 students, but okay. I capped it at 21, and I had a list of probably that long of students who wanted to get in. Yeah. But I had to cap it, and the reason why I had to cap it is you can't have a martial arts class with 50 students. Yeah. You have to have it at 21. So it was that size. That's the right size for a seminar. But they all came, and they all engaged, and they all felt a connection to this material. Some of them came in thinking, this is, you know, martial arts is ridiculous, right? This is a ridiculous kind of thing, but they wanted to read the text, and they wanted to kind of talk about how these lofty philosophical principles lead to this, you know, brutality. Others came in the opposite direction. They think they practice martial arts for a while, and they think it's this beautiful thing akin to some connection between dance and like magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to maybe understand something, you know, in a different direction. So I had a great variety of students. A majority of my students were women, for example. So 11 were women, 10 were men. So we had a really fascinating mix. And in this process, a number of issues came up that I felt were emblematic of the martial arts. That is, issues about the self. They talked about themselves. They talked about themselves as perhaps Asian Americans, as women, as men in particular roles in society, women in particular roles in society, their futures, whether they were going off to grad school or going off to work in public service. I had people in the military or entering the military I had people who had served in the military in this class. So I had a really fantastic group of students. And as you know, often this is what it boils down to. You know, we can do whatever we can, even in a lecture course, we think we're in charge, but it's the spirit of students. And if you get students as great as the students I had, you know, the course just transforms itself into something fantastic. And I think that that's what happened. I hope that they had a wonderful time in this class, and that they walked away from it you know, really accepting that one always learns with one's body and one's mind at the same time. And life is just an infinite series of lessons.
Well, it sounds like there was a lot of transcendence going on in that class and a lot of self-actualization, which I want to thank you for being on the show today because I've learned a lot in the hour or so that we've been talking here. So, Christian, we might have to have you back at some other time to discuss more of these Eastern Asian religion type stuff. And thank you once again for being on Research on Religion.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.